might limit unions in some cases, that it was more important to stop the special interest in corporate money. I think part of McCain-Feingold got ruled unconstitutional, and so at the end of the day, it probably hasn't proved to be that effective.
Yeah. It's also led to, well, jumping back too to the whole that in the 2010 in particular, the 2010, like you say, the Citizens United, seems to me there's quite a bit of press out there that, oh, this is simply going to open the floodgates for the unions, you know, and union dues shouldn't be spent on this.
Well, I think the right wing is trying to say that to counter the efforts to pass the legislation. They're going to try and say it's unfairly structured to benefit unions, but truth again is corporations just have infinitely more resources than the labor movement. So,
Okay. The other thing, you've been involved in a number of things, so I'm just sort of going through the list here. Healthcare, of course. You know, you mentioned John Dingell earlier, and you know, his father before him, and John Dingell, the longest serving congressman, pushed for healthcare. The UAW has pushed for health care reform for almost its entire existence, but in particular since the 50s and 60s. So we passed health care in 2010, a version of it. So I wondered if you could first address your role in health care over the years.
Well, it's, I guess, one of the two issues that I've worked on most continuously since I came to Washington. The very first bill I worked on when I came here was a legislation to provide health care for unemployed workers. And that was 82, 83. We were right in the midst of a recession. Lots of people thrown out of work. And worked with Dingell and Henry Waxman. We passed the bill through the House of Representatives. Got killed by Bob Dole over in the Senate. The very familiar story, but I really cut my teeth on the whole process of a bill moving all the way through the House. I worked with bringing a UAW member who was laid off in to testify at one of the hearings. And then, I mean, going forward, I can remember in preparation for the whole Clinton effort, there was first a huge debate within the labor movement over what type of reforms we should push for. And UAW was in the camp of the unions pushing for single payer, and there was another whole camp that didn't want that, especially a lot of the building trades unions. And in retrospect, it's sort of ironic, but it became this major fight within the labor movement over which way presidents were going to vote and who would have the majority on the executive council. And I remember in the end, John Sweeney was the vote that swung it away from single payer. To me, it all seems sort of ironic now, given that Congress wasn't about to pass a single payer bill. But anyways, we had the huge efforts under President Clinton to pass health care reform. One of the most painful experiences I ever went through. I mean, we had such high hopes, and there was all the effort into crafting the plan, and then to see it go down the tubes. And I remember I even canceled, I had a week's vacation scheduled for August at the beach, because, you know, Congress always adjourns in August, and they didn't that year because they were still trying to do health care reform. And it was just agony watching the bill die in the Senate. And then in the House, they weren't able to get it through some of the key committees. And also, one of the disheartening things at the time, as much as we were committed to the bill, and you know, working around the clock here, and UAW spent a lot of money in support of that effort, the UAW grassroots pressure was not there. And talking with our folks later, the reaction of many UAW members was, what does this have to do with me? I've got good health care under our contracts. And I think a lot of them got scared by the GOP propaganda, the Harry and Louise, and is this going to make things worse, you know, for me? And despite the long history of the UAW being for national health care, when the Clinton effort was made, we didn't have our own membership behind us, at least not aggressively telling their members, you got to vote for this. The other thing I remember about that effort was one small piece of the Clinton plan was to was dealing with early retirees, and would have been a particular benefit to auto, steel industries that had a lot of legacy costs. And we worked this great coalition up with the auto companies and steel companies to specifically lobby for that provision. And we thought we were so smart that business labor, this would really be successful. And what we found, it was an absolute disaster. The liberal members of Congress looked at it and saw the corporations and said, this is terrible, this is just a boondoggle for corporations. And Republican members looked at the union part of it and said, we don't want any part of that. And I mean, it was like the Titanic. The effort just went down the tubes. I remember vividly taking the coalition in to meet with Representative Pete Stark, and Stark had not realized that there was corporations were going to be in there. And he came into the meeting and saw the companies. He went berserk and became abusive and. Wound up swearing at the companies and stomping out. It was a lesson to me that sometimes having coalitions like that is not the most effective way. Sometimes you're better just working your own sides of the aisle. There were very efforts at incremental reforms like the S-CHIP expansion and all of that, but obviously the culmination was the Obama effort that finally succeeded. And this time around, I think UAW members were more engaged. I think one of the impacts of all of a sudden what happened with the auto industry and the restructuring, people realized, hey, our health benefits are not that secure, and so I think that made a difference in the reaction of our own membership. And I'm very proud of the role that President Gettelfinger played within the labor movement. It wasn't clear in the key days at the end that the labor movement would support the bill, because some people were upset about the excise tax on health care plans, even though we had been able to moderate it. Other people had other separate concerns. And as was often the case when they would have the calls of the executive council members, the people who have a complaint sometimes speak up more loudly, even though they may not reflect mm-hmm. the broad view. But President Gettelfinger spoke up very clearly and strongly, saying, you know, the time has come. We've got to seize this opportunity to pass health care reform. And I think it was very helpful in getting the majority to say, yes, the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, is going to go on record urging people to vote for this. And we contributed a lot of money to the coalition, the Health Care for America Now coalition, that spearheaded the campaign for reform. And we were involved in the crucial final days trying to round up the votes in the House. That was an example where we had the list of who were the undecided members, and I set up phone calls with a lot of them, went to visit a lot of them. I even remember in particular a meeting talking with Representative Jim Cooper. The thing about Jim Cooper is he had been a member of Congress during the failed Clinton effort and had been a fairly conservative member, and he had been a critic of that, and you know, we had had great debates then, and we were never able to convince him, and then he got defeated and was absent for a while, but then he got reelected to a different district. So here all these years later, he's now once again a member of Congress, and we're now faced with the Obama effort. And I mean, both of us were in the meeting with him talking about, we've been through this before, and we don't want to go through another failed effort. And yes, this is an imperfect product, but if we fail and get nothing, everything's going to be worse. You know, we'll be even worse on not having cost containment, we'll be worse on not having coverage, and so let's get this job done finally, even though it's not everything he would want or I would want. And to me, it was just an indication of, I guess, two old veterans of the battles and the benefits of wisdom of seeing what's happened in past battles. And, anyways, it was a huge thrill for me, getting it passed. And I went to the event that the White House scheduled at the Armory for all the advocates of healthcare reform to witness the signing, and the president coming by later after the formal White House signing to talk to folks. And it, I mean, all of us in the room there were sort of, we can't believe it's finally happened after all these decades, and so many good friends that I'd worked with over the years who also dedicated their lives to healthcare reform. And anyways, it's, to me, it's probably the proudest accomplishment of all the years. And I feel good in retiring that, well, the year I retired is the year this piece of our dream was finally realized.
Retire on top. But you would, as I understand it from your earlier remarks, is you've literally been involved with working on healthcare for about 27 years here since you came in 83.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's been a consistent thing for 27 years.
Yes.
How do you feel about the new bill?
Well, I think it's amazing. We have our work cut out for us in ensuring that it gets implemented properly. And there's going to be the attacks from Republicans to try and undermine it. There'll be lots of regulatory battles in the states. But, you know, providing coverage to 32 million people, it's incredible. I think long term, all the steps to contain healthcare costs are going to be critically important. I know a lot of people don't realize it, but in the law, there's all these demonstration projects, pilot programs on how to deliver care, quality care, but more efficiently, so we hold down costs. And I think that's going to be crucial going forward. So, one of the immediate benefits of the law is this early retiree reinsurance program, which will be very important, I think, to helping to preserve coverage for early retirees. So the insurance market reforms, the whole exchange system that will be set up in the states will hopefully provide coverage more efficiently, to, especially to people who are in the individual market.
You must have faced fierce opposition from the insurance companies.
Yeah, they led the opposition. The Obama administration did a lot of smart things to try and isolate the insurance industry and make sure there was the coalition that was needed to pass the legislation. Obviously, the expanded Democratic majorities as a result of the last two election cycles was crucial, too.
It also seemed that, again, as a layperson, just reading this all through the papers and whatever, media I read, that all of a sudden Obama started digging in on this. And what do you have any, inside knowledge or your perspective on what changed in his attitude to make this happen?
Well, I think he was told by Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid that he needed to use the bully pulpit, that without that presidential oomph, you know, weren't going to be able to get the votes. And then I think it was Wellpoint sort of did him a favor by all of a sudden announcing they were jacking up their rates an incredible amount. And that really, I think, helped crystallize or gave the president a point he could talk about to crystallize what the reform effort was about. And I think that really had an impact on the public. And then I give tremendous credit to Speaker Pelosi. She was really single-minded about, we're going to get this done, we're going to find a way to get the votes in the House. And even when people said, you know, after the Massachusetts special election deprived us of the 60 votes in the Senate, and it became clear the only way forward was this two-step process of having the House pass the Senate comprehensive bill and then using budget reconciliation to do a fix-it bill. It took enormous effort for the Speaker to persuade House Democrats to go along with the Senate bill as the first step. And but she was just relentless and persuasive, and I think she deserves all the praise for being able to get it done. I mean, she's been a very, very strong Speaker. This was a indication of that.
Well, it's a major, you know, bill for the United States. Many of the pundits believe, and many historians, that it's the most influential bill since the 60s, the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Would you, what would your position be?
I absolutely agree. And then going back before that, maybe the Social Security. I think it ranks right up there in that same category. I mean, the Civil Rights Act of 64 changed our whole nation. And I think the health care bill will have that same impact. Healthcare is, I mean, has such an important impact on the overall economy, not to mention the well-being of the American public. So, yeah, I think it's enormous.
The another issue of your many would be pensions. You've done some work with pensions.
That's the other area where really it started from the time I came to Washington, continuing to today. When I started as a lawyer in Detroit, I also worked a lot on pensions, especially plant closing situations is when the lawyers would get brought in. And one of the specific horror stories I remember was Lear Siegler closed its automotive division in Detroit, and even though the parent company, Lear Siegler, was very profitable, they were able to terminate the pension plan covering the automotive division and just dump it on the PBGC, and PBGC didn't guarantee all the benefits, so there were these losses. Now, we sued the company, and through litigation, we were able to recoup the pension stuff. But it was an illustration of some of the abuses that were going on. And so the very first pension bill I worked on was the reforms to the whole Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation to change its structure to prevent these types of abuses. And we actually, at that time, a portion of the employer community also wanted reforms because the good employers were worried about irresponsible companies just dumping liabilities on the PBGC and shifting the cost to everyone else. And the interesting thing in that pension effort was sort of the first time we used the budget reconciliation process to sort of short-circuit the normal legislative process. And we basically went to the House Labor Committee and said, stick this in your budget reconciliation package, and we can zip it through. And that happened, but then we got involved in a huge jurisdictional fight because the Ways and Means Committee wanted to control it. So they stuck a competing version in their reconciliation package, and the House actually pass both things at the same time, two contradictory tension bills. Then we went over to the Senate and were able to get them to act. And I always remember, normally when you have a fight between the tax committees and the labor committees, the tax committees always win because they're just stronger. And we thought that's what was going to happen again. But when that conference on the pension legislation came up, it just happened that Chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski, needed something else on a tax bill, and so he basically backed off on the pension stuff, and we were able to get most of our version through, and it got enacted in 1986. And I felt great at the time that, you know, here's this thing I had worked on. That I actually brought in a person from the Lear-Siegler Automotive Decision, a retiree, to testify about the abuses that had happened. And I mean, so I really felt, boy, we really solved it. We now, you know, solved the pension issue for all time. What I didn't realize is every, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, Congress has always come back and had to do another pension bill on some other aspect. And there was, you know, a big funding bill that happened, I think, in the early 90s, and then when the Republicans were in control, they came back with a very draconian pension bill, and we had a big fight, and now, pending right now in Congress, is another, more minor, but a pension funding bill to try and provide some relief. So I've sort of learned, it's an example of how issues keep coming back over and over again. The other pension story I remember, it's when the Republicans were in control and they were pushing this terribly draconian pension bill. It's after the steel companies and the airline companies had dumped their pension liabilities on the PBGC. And the Republicans basically hated defined benefit plans, so they structured this bill that was so draconian on the funding rules that it would basically drive companies to get rid of their defined benefit plans. And we tried to fight it. And there was also other provisions that limited benefits that plans could offer that would have basically forced the auto companies to have to freeze their pension plans so that even though people kept working, they wouldn't have earned any more pension benefits. And the Republicans were in control, and, you know, we kept telling them this makes no sense, this is bad, and they weren't listening to us at all. And, I mean, the auto companies didn't want the draconian pension legislation to pass, and they kept saying, well, we'll try and work behind the scenes. They didn't want to offend the Republicans. And so we kept trying to work with them behind the scenes, and we just got stiffed totally. And so finally, we decided, okay, enough of this behind the scenes. We're going to unleash our grassroots. And so we went to folks at grassroots and said, this pension legislation means your pension plans are going to be frozen. And at first, some of our folks didn't believe it. They the Republicans wouldn't do that to us. And we had to get the actual bill language and show our people. And when that happened, our people went berserk in the plants. We were passing cell phones down the line, and the calls started pouring in to some of these Republican offices. And all of a sudden, I had Republican members calling me saying, you know, okay, what can we do to fix this? And all of a sudden, I got called to a meeting, myself and the GM lobbyist, to a meeting. I always remember it with then Republican Majority Leader John Boehner and Chairman of the Ways and Means Committee Bill Thomas to talk about, okay, what do we need to do to fix it? And we gave them the fixes that would stop our pension plans from being frozen, and they took the fix, and then we went along with the pension legislation. Again, it was a vivid illustration to me of the power of the grassroots, because before that, our inside the Beltway lobbying wasn't making any difference at all. the other thing I remember, we then had to struggle with what was happening in the legislation in the Senate, and it then came down to this House-Senate conference, and we still had problems with various pieces of the legislation we were trying to improve, and the focus of the problem was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Bill Thomas, who was notorious for being, you know, having a hot temper, and everyone sort of went around afraid of him. And for some reason, I was at the UAW convention right at the time when this was all happening, and I spent a lot of the time on the phone talking with folks back in Washington, and at several points, it wound up, instead of the companies, it wound up me being the one that had to talk to Bill Thomas. And you asked me before, did he get through to members? Well, getting through to the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, usually that doesn't happen. Usually you talk to staff. But what I didn't realize is Bill Thomas had a thing. If he didn't let his staff negotiate for him, he did it himself. And so, you know, several times I'd have to call back to Bill Thomas, and they put me right through to him. And I'm sort of sitting there on the phone quaking. but I had these direct phone calls with him. And you know, we're on diametrically opposed ends of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And another point in the conversation, we thought everything was finally worked out. And one of the Republican members on the Ways and Means Committee mentions to Bill Thomas, he sees him, he says, "Well, I'm glad it's all been worked out." Well, Bill Thomas didn't like it that he was hearing this from other places, and so he threw a fit. And so I have another member, a Republican member of Ways and Means, calling me up and saying, "This is a Bill Thomas management problem. You've got to call Bill Thomas to soothe over the ruffled feathers." And I'm thinking, you're asking me to do that. But I wound up doing that, and again, they put me right through to him. And then I remember the last phone conversation I had with him. He basically is trying to chisel me back on certain provisions. And, you know, well, what if we modified this? And he was trying to modify it so it would only protect GM and not Ford. And I'm saying, well, we've got to be even-handed.
Yeah.
and then, you know, I'm trying to say, if you do all this, we'll support the final product. And he comes back and he says, "Oh, I don't want to give you that much to get your support. I just, you know, I'm not going to give you that much." And I have to try and say, "Well, you know, we really want to get there all the way to be supportive." And at the end of the day, we got there. But I'll never forget, it's like I got in the position of UAW, you know, labor lobbyist, being the one who's talking to Bill Thomas about it, not the corporate guys.
The lion tamer.
Yeah, it was bizarre.
Yeah. There, of course, you hear, especially over the last few years, a lot of folks, just forget about defined benefits, period. Just give everyone their, you know, tell them to contribute to an IRA, and if the company can afford it, put a little few bucks in with the IRA and leave everyone to themselves. What's your position on that?
Well, UAW's always been against that, because and what happened during the 2008-2009 financial collapse, you know, illustrates that. People who thought they were sitting pretty with their 401ks and IRAs all of a sudden weren't anymore. All of the experts say a defined benefit plan gives greater retirement security, greater protection. But clearly the long-term trend has been away from defined benefits. And I think we were fortunate in the UAW that we maintained the pension plans in the auto industry, the defined benefit plans. But in many, many other places, labor movements lost them. My fear is that the public sector is where the next battleground is, with a lot of the states trying to get rid of their defined benefit plans. So it's mm-hmm. a continuing struggle.
And I'll step back slightly, and there was something I was going to mention earlier, had it down and skipped over it, the VBAs. You know, we've talked a bit about health care and a bit about pensions. This is somewhat in between, and I understand that you're not involved in contract negotiations, but I just wondered if you were involved in the 2007 contracts and the setting up these VBAs, because that puts a whole different tone on healthcare for the UAW members.
Yeah, I was not involved in the direct negotiations, but the whole auto restructuring, you obviously had a mixture of, yes, we renegotiated the contracts with the companies, but it was also with the direct involvement of the Obama administration and congressional leaders too. So, and we did, during the whole auto restructuring, there was this huge effort to try and explain to people that, look, the UAW has been giving concessions steadily over the years, 2005, 2007, and now once again with the auto restructuring, because, you know, there was this myth out there of auto workers being paid $76 an hour, and, you know, and we were deeply involved in preparing the testimony that President Gettelfinger gave twice in the fall, I guess, of 2008, I guess it was.
Time flies.
Yeah. And those were very, very difficult because the public animosity towards the CEOs just sort of overwhelmed everything. And it was very difficult to get people to focus on what's going to happen to the workers and retirees. And you had the whole, you know, the right-wingers were all, oh, these auto workers are overpaid, the retirees are overpaid. And so we were continually fighting that and fighting the crowd that just said, let them go down the tubes, it'll be fine, the Japanese transplants will just pick up the slack. And of course, everyone, that all always ignored what would happen to the retirees. The retirees would have been hurt the worst. And then with the ultimate restructuring and the stock going into the VIBAs, there was then this whole other debate, again, I think a lot of it pushed by the right-wing commentators about, you know, how it was somehow unfair that a portion of the stock was going to the retirees, mm-hmm. and more should have gone to the bondholders, which always sort of blew my mind that most of the bondholders were institutional investors. And, you know, to me, it's just so clear of, it's more important to protect retirees who gave their whole life working for a company and who are now totally dependent for health care on the VIBA. It's going to be a big issue going forward to try and make sure that in terms of what happens with the VIBA, we're involved right now in trying to make sure that the VIBA participates in this early retiree reinsurance program that's part of the health care reform law.
Mm-hmm. I imagine those were heady times for you here during the restructuring, since, you know, obviously it couldn't have occurred without the Obama administration's involvement.
Well, we probably want to, maybe I should back up from the beginning of the whole.
Right, we sort of segued into the topic, so as long as you're on it, it was another topic on my list.
During the early summer of 2008, we started to hear from the companies who, and I guess they were looking at what was happening to sales, that, oh my God, they might be in deep trouble. And the initial legislative effort, beginning in the fall of 2008, was to pass the extra funding for the program that provides grants and loans to the companies if they invest in domestic production of advanced vehicles.
And this was under the Bush administration.
Right. And in the past, the companies had always paid lip service to that, but weren't terribly interested. But with the financial crisis, all of a sudden they saw, oh, maybe this could help them get an infusion of money, sort of a back doorway of having a bridge loan. And so we had that effort, which ultimately we were successful in getting the money. But it clearly became apparent that that wasn't going to be nearly enough. And And then the push came for, okay, we need a bridge loan. And so the first step was the hearings. And as I said, it was very frustrating that the main focus seemed to be the hostility towards the CEOs. And it was very upsetting to me that even some of our Democratic friends were more interested in taking pot shots at the CEOs just to do sort of grandstanding, as opposed to, you know, it's really important for hundreds of thousands of retirees and workers and communities to get this assistance. And then, so we got the legislation finally through the House, but in the Senate, it was clear that the Republicans were balking, and the climax came when Senator Corker put forward his alternative proposal. And I got a call from Majority Leader Reid's people saying, well, is there any basis to negotiate with Corker? And we had looked at the Corker amendment, and there's really three components to it. One was, I think half of the, or maybe it was two-thirds of the bondholders' claims had to be converted to equity. We were totally fine with that. Second was on the retiree health piece of it, was to convert that to equity. And then the third piece of it was, and the compensation for the actives needed to go down to the level of the transplants, and we had problems with that. So we said to Reid's folks, yeah, we think there's a basis to negotiate. And so I got called middle of the afternoon to go up and wound up in a room with Senator Corker, and Senator Dodd was there, and part of the time Senator Durbin and then various staffs, and to try and negotiate out. It was somewhat galling, though, because the House had already passed a package that the administration signed off on, so we sort of felt like, hey, why are Senate Republicans not going along with what the Bush administration? But be that as it may, it was clear, you know, Corker was now their point person. One of the interesting things about this negotiating session was the companies were kept out of the room. So it's the UAW and Corker. And the very first 5 minutes, I say to Corker, we're fine with the bondholder claims being exchanged for equity. The second piece on the VEBA, we need clarification. The way you're amendment is written, it says every time the companies are required to make a cash payment to the VEBA, at that point in time, they'll convert part of it to stock. And is that what you really mean? It's not an upfront thing, it's as you go along. And he said, yeah, that's what I mean. And he said, well, we're fine with that, because you just value however much stock you need at the time based on its price, but you're getting the same value. And so the two most significant economic things, we really had agreed that there needed to be language written up, there was drafting issues, but there was really no debate over the guts of his proposal. And all the rest of it was on the third piece of it, which was how our compensation had to be dragged down to the level of transplants. And what we said to him is, look, our contract that we've already negotiated provides for this lower new tier for new hires. We're going to come in now much lower than the transplants. So already this is going to happen. It's just going to question of how quickly people are going to be hired. We don't know that. It depends on the economy. And so it doesn't make sense to say by such and such a date this has to happen. And we went round and round and round. And at the end of the day, my memory is we reached a deal with Corker on a provision that would say there has to be changes, but not specifying, you know, a date, just that there needs to be changes that whoever the administration appoints to oversee the restructuring will say are sufficient, and if that administrator says it's not, the stick would be the companies would be forced to file for bankruptcy. it's not what Corker wanted. It wasn't the date certain you're at the transplant level. But my memory is he said, okay, we'll try that. Well, he took it back to the caucus, and it, my understanding is he didn't try and sell it, and he got hooted down, and the word came back very quickly, they're rejecting the whole thing. And so we were at a stalemate, and so Reed then just put up what had passed the House, and the Republicans blocked it, and that was the end of it. I'll add that during this whole negotiating session with Corker, I was constantly on the phone talking to President Gettelfinger and our general counsel. So it wasn't just me by myself. But it, I mean, this all went till about midnight that night. And it's the most incredible atmosphere I've ever been in because there was such intense focus. At one point, I think about 8 o'clock, I stepped out of the room to go down the hall to the bathroom, and I didn't realize the media was all camped out. So I step out, and there's these blinding lights and cameras, and all the reporters are yelling at me, and I just never experienced anything like that. And I mean, the other thing was just the worry that, well, if this goes down, there's no bridge loans legislatively. You know, this could mean the end of the companies. Now, in the discussions with President Gettelfinger, he said, through some of our contacts, we've received some hints that the Bush administration will not let the companies go down, that they will act on their own with the TARP money. And I think that gave us a little bit of encouragement that we didn't have to go along with Corker's original proposal. Corker said publicly later that he felt the signals that the administration sent undermined his attempt to negotiate with us.
Corker sort of came out of nowhere with that. He was not a well-known senator, and it appears had not made a name for himself and with any other major forum, and all of a sudden he comes up with this proposal.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, after the legislation went down, you know, he was on all the talk shows playing it as hard as he could. And that was very distressing to us. But yeah, I think he earned a lot of points in the conservative community. He was the guy who took on the UAW. And as the when it became clear then that the announcement from Treasury that they were going to act due to bridge loans, Corker, of course, started discussions with them, and he eventually got his provisions into the terms for the bridge loans. But I remember he called up President Gettelfinger again because he wanted to try and negotiate further with us, and President Gettelfinger had me call him back. Because by this time we didn't trust him at all, because we'd seen he just ran to the media with his spin on everything. And when I talked to Senator Corker on the phone and said, I'm returning the call from President Gettelfinger, he didn't want to talk if he couldn't talk directly with Gettelfinger. And it just confirmed to me that it was all about him wanting more PR spin.
Grandstanding.
But, so the, you know, the Bush administration did the bridge loans with essentially putting in the Corker terms. So the Obama administration comes in, and the UAW's original thought was, well, we'll go to the Obama folks and we'll get them to take out these provisions we think are too onerous. And that turned out to be a total miscalculation. It became clear pretty early on that the Obama administration didn't think they had any latitude to start monkeying around with the terms of the bridge loans. And then it also became clear that if anything, well, as it turned out in the restructuring negotiations with the Obama folks, they wound up setting terms that were even harsher than what Corker had been negotiating for. Now, the industry's situation had gotten even worse by that time. But in the end, we became convinced that the guiding point for the Obama folks was they wanted to make absolutely sure if they were going to give more money that the companies weren't going to fail 6 months down the road, that they were going to be so tough and so austere in what they did in the restructuring that the companies would survive even if auto sales continued along at 10 million units a year. And so, you know, they were even tougher on bondholders, but they were also much tougher on the VEBA. I mean, we didn't get stock every time a contribution was due. We got stock up front, and it was whittled down from, you know, the amount that we thought we were entitled to. And the active workers had to take further cuts in compensation were much more drastic. So I know a lot of the right-wing folks like to attack the Obama administration for having favored us in the renegotiations. We don't view it that way at all. They were extremely tough, and there was a lot of very hard stuff that we had to accept as part of the restructuring. Having said that, we also realized that but for that assistance, GM and Chrysler wouldn't be here, and if they had gone down, Ford probably wouldn't be here either. And more of the suppliers would have gone down the tubes too. So and in most of the actual negotiations with the Obama administration on the terms of the new contracts, that was done by President Gettelfinger and our general counsel and others. So we weren't as directly involved in that here in Washington, but we were involved a lot then in explaining what was being done and trying to justify that to people on the Hill and giving talking points and trying to respond to some of the Republican propaganda that was still attacking us.
Mm-hmm. By all appearances, President Gettelfinger did a fine job of negotiations and presenting the UAW perspective. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think he did a fantastic job. I think it was the most difficult situation any UAW president's ever faced.
Clearly.
And, knowing that there were terrible, terrible things in the new agreements of benefits being lost, increased risk for the retirees, dozens of plants being closed, and yet the alternative was even worse, losing everything. And trying to preserve as much as we could for the existing folks, realizing that going forward, new workers, it's a different deal. So I think he did a magnificent job under incredible pressure. we had some staunch allies on the Hill, John Dingell, Sandy Levin, Michigan senators, but it was disheartening to see so many other Democratic friends being more interested in responding to the concerns of auto dealers or concerns of other stakeholders and not so concerned about what was happening to UAW active and retired members. But I think, again, it goes back to members respond to what's in their district. And members that didn't have a auto plant, then maybe the only real thing for their district was auto dealers. So you had all these conflicting interests of different stakeholders. And
it appears to me, as a historian, of course, this is very recent history, but it appears to me that one of the successes in this is that the UAW still retained a good measure of influence within the American automobile industry that could have easily been totally wiped out for any kind of influence. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. I mean, as I said, but for the assistance by the Obama administration, GM and Chrysler would have ceased to exist. And we think that would have dragged Ford down too. So, you know, half the UAW would have disappeared.
Which goes back to numbers.
I think that the whole future of the union would have been very much called into question. The cuts were painful. The membership losses that were sustained, very painful. But the union, you know, remains. Things are starting to swing back now. I think, you know, we're poised to continue the fights going forward. So, and I think Ron Gettelfinger can take credit for that. I, in one analogy, sort of used with some folks, you know, the Revolutionary War and for the United States, and what George Washington went through, and Valley Forge, and all of that, and you know, all the setbacks that they suffered, and yet, in the end, keeping things together to finally win the victory. And I sort of feel, in a way, that keeping things together so we didn't lose everything, so that we kept the companies and we kept the union intact. And I think he deserves great credit for that.
Another area that you've been involved with has been Social Security. So perhaps you could address your work with that.
Well, once again, one of the very first issues I worked on when I came to Washington was at that time the plan to financially put Social Security on a better basis, the whole program that went through in 1983. And the UAW strongly supported the package at that time. Ironically, one of the group of unions that opposed it was the federal employee unions, because they brought federal workers all into Social Security. We supported that because we thought it. I say it's ironic because I wound up marrying a woman who now is the lead lobbyist for the federal employee union. The more recent effort on Social Security, of course, was the effort by the Bush administration to privatize the whole system, and that's something we worked very closely with other unions in opposing. And I feel proud of the campaign because it, you know, we were concerned Republicans control Congress and the White House, are they just going to roll this through? But I think thanks to our efforts and the grassroots pressure, again, we were able to get the public aroused that this was really a threat and would be a bad deal. And of course, the collapse of the stock market too, I think, exposed the fallacy of the privatizers. But I feel the labor movement, the UAW, did a great job in being part of the coalition that stopped the privatization efforts. Now, of course, with the whole discussion about deficits now, there's going to be another set of battles. So people want to try and use the deficit as an excuse to privatize or slash Social Security, and I'm sure going forward we'll be involved in trying to prevent that.
Mm-hmm. And there were talks, of course, of privatization in this area as well.
Right.
So, another area that you've worked with, I'd like to know how closely you worked with and how the effect it's been is, but with National Labor Relations Board.
Well, the whole area of labor law reform has been a continuing area that we've worked on. I must say it's probably if healthcare is the area I feel proudest of in terms of our accomplishments, the area of labor law reform is the area I feel, I guess, the worst about, that we've never been able to make the type of progress that we hope for. The first major campaign that I recall was the whole fight over the striker replacement legislation. That's the legislation that would have changed a law to prohibit employers from being able to permanently replace striking workers. It's a weapon that companies have used to break unions and undermine unions to dictate collective bargaining terms. And it was really the UAW and other industrial unions that spearheaded the move to make this a big issue. And I remember bringing in a UAW member who had been permanently replaced in the strike to testify at a hearing. And it was very moving to me, these people who had basically had their lives destroyed by employers using the tactic. And there were even some in the labor movement who didn't want to make this a big issue, but it's something that really resonated with the rank and file. And so we and other industrial unions started a campaign, basically, and the AFL-CIO eventually had to get on board. And we were able to pass legislation in the House, but again ran into the problem of the Republican filibuster in the Senate. And I think there was two separate efforts we made, two successive Congresses. And of course our hope was, with Bill Clinton coming in, that he would be able to help swing over the Arkansas senators, and that turned out not to be the case, despite the lip service from the administration supporting it. He never twisted the arms to, or at least was not effective in twisting their arms, and we never got their votes. I remember the last time the vote came up in the Senate was during a UAW convention. I actually delayed going out to the UAW convention because of that, because I felt I had to be off the Senate floor. And I remember calling back to President Bieber to report that we had lost again, and which, you know, when the news was communicated to the UAW convention, of course, there was lots of groans. And, I don't regret at all fighting for that cause. In retrospect, I'm not so sure we did the right strategy of, when we didn't have the votes, still pushing to have a vote. I remember at the time Senate Democratic leaders saying, "Do you really want us to push it to a vote? Because we're going to lose." And we just had gone so far, we felt, you know, we want to have people on record. We can't go back to our members and say we never got a vote. But so we got the vote, but that was the nail in the coffin, and that the issue went away. We could never come back to it, because it was always clear that we didn't have the votes. And we didn't ever really try and explore, well, is there a compromise that'll get us the votes? So the other major campaign, of course, has been the campaign for the Employee Free Choice Act, which you know, we spent several years educating members of Congress about it, and then we were able to pass the bill through the House with President Obama and the expanded Democratic majorities coming in after the 2008 elections. You know, on paper, we said, okay, we have an opportunity now. We have a president who'll sign it, and we think we, on paper, have 60 votes in the Senate. Immediately, we ran into a House member saying, well, you get it through the Senate first and then bring it, but we don't want to walk the plank if you can't get it through the Senate. And so there's very intensive efforts to try and nail down the votes in the Senate. And Arlen Specter and Blanche Lincoln and some of the others made it clear that they needed modifications. So there were negotiations going on, and we were still hopeful that there was going to be a package this time that would make some compromises but would nail it down and get it done. But then the Massachusetts election happened, and it was clear we no longer had 60 votes. And once that happened, a number of the conservative Democrats backed up, and So we're once again faced with, we don't have the votes now. This time, I think we're smart enough to, we're not going to call for a vote until, you know, something changes. But it is very frustrating to see once again on such a crucial issue for the labor movement that we're not able to get the ball over the goal line.